February 14, 1978, Peggy Bulger collecting from W.H. Hammock of Jasper, Florida. Mr. Hammock is a 93-year-old saw sharpener and a man who knows how to hammer cross-cut saws flat, an old sawmill operator. We'll be set. Testing. And Mr. Hammock, could you first tell me where you were born and who your parents were?
I'm W.H. Hammock, and I was born at Cuthbert, Georgia, on the second day of December, 1884. When I was a small boy, my father moved the family of eight children to South Georgia, near Moultrie, between Moultrie and Doran, Georgia, maybe nearer to Albany, Georgia. And we lived there on the farm. He had 1,000 acres of land and had 5 boys and 2 girls. There was actually 7. There's one that died when he was small. There's actually 8 in all. But we had a lumber mill a few miles away near the Okanagan River. And some of the boys worked on the farm and some worked at the lumber mill. And he had 6 horses and mules, and we plowed the farm and run it. But when I grew a little older and larger, I'd rather work at the lumber mill. So I learned to set head blocks for my father to saw, and my oldest brother was a sawyer. And finally, I learned how to saw. And we had the lumber mill first up in Mitchell County, near Albany. Then we moved back to near Doran, Georgia.
Do you know when farm. That was? What year that was when you moved back?
We moved back about 1902. And I worked on the farm like the rest did, some, but I worked mostly at the lumber mill after I learned how to saw, after I was about 16 years of age. I was 16 in 1900. And I learned how to saw a little and finally got to be a sawyer. Then I operated a mill for my oldest brother, Herschel Hamill, near Moultrie, Georgia. Finally, I wound up by buying an interest in the mill, and we operated there for a few years. And then I had a job down near Quincy, Florida, to operate a very large lumber mill for the Southern Tobacco Company of Quincy. And we manufactured lumber to build the tobacco barns and also shade lath to cover the shade tobacco. And while I was working there, I was getting in my 20s. And I was courting a girl in Thomasville, Georgia, Miss Leola Connolly.
How'd you meet her?
I met her because my sister lived next door, and she introduced me, and we went to her home one evening. My sister wanted me to meet her, and she was at the piano, and some other young people were singing. When we entered the room, they stopped singing. And it was all introduced, and then she wanted my sister to play some, which she did. Then my girl that I had just met, she played some more. After that, I would court her once in a while. I had to be away quite a bit. We carried on a courtship, I'll say, about 2 years. And we became engaged. And I was down at Quincy operating the mill there and had to go by train and change cars a time or two to see her in Thomasville. And we were married on the 6th day of December, 1908. And
you were still working in Quincy at that time?
I had moved up to Worth County near Sylvester, Georgia, and was operating, I was owner and operator of a sawmill, shingle mill, and ginnery, and grist mill and threshing machines. Steam mill, them days we had no gasoline motors much in the country. We used steam for motive power.
Did you buy steam engines or?
Yes, we bought them. Bought the steam engines. I operated the mill there for, I'll say about a year. Then my brother obtained a job for me down at Moultrie, Georgia, to be shipping clerk for the Huber Norman Lumber Company. And I was
Where
on
is that.
That was in Moultrie, Georgia.
In Moultrie, okay.
And I was shipping clerk for Huber Norman Lumber Company there for about a year, I guess. And then a man named Will Ireland hired me to superintend and operate his lumber mill near Tifton, Georgia. And we moved there and cut out the timber and moved from there to Cordele, Georgia to work for a salary for a man. Hard for me to remember his name right now, but anyway, we went out from Cordele. I lived in Cordele, but the mill was out near Riverside on the Flint River, and I operated the mill for him for a year, such a matter. And I moved from Cordele, Georgia, to White Springs in 1916.
Well, what made you move from Cordele to White Springs?
Man by the name of Griffith that I had operated a mill for much earlier, a lawyer from Alabama. He was down there in business with the Radnor Gabbett Lumber Company, cutting timber known as the Captain Cone timber. And I operated a mill for him for a while, and then bought the mill and operated it myself, and it had a tram road to it. We cut some very fine timber during World War I. And the Germans sank a lot of the good lumber that we manufactured out in the Atlantic, because Uncle Sam wanted some wooden ships after the Germans had sank so many of our steel ships. And after I finished cutting out that timber, I moved the mill down on the Suwannee River, south of White Springs, and operated there on the banks of the river and floated some logs down the river and pulled them out with a boom across the river.
Oh, right down to the Gulf? You went all the way down?
That was right just below White Springs.
Uh-huh. Well, when below White Springs, is it where that old railroad trestle is? Is it right around there that your mill was? If you go on 41 south?
Well, it was actually just about a couple of miles down the river, just on the bend of the river.
Uh-huh.
And there was not any tram road to it there at that particular time. We floated the logs down the river.
How far down did you float the logs?
Well, some of the logs was put in the river up near the Big Shoal, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's so many shoals in the river, it's hard to float the logs down. I had to keep some boys with rowboats pushing the logs off of the shoulders, long and along. I used a young man named Charlie Smart, and Ed Silas, and some other boys around White Springs, and some colored and some white.
And they would be in rowboats and try to just keep the logs moving?
Push them off with push poles. And I worked many of the colored people around White Springs when I had the mill out on the tram road. Jake McCallum, and he had three brothers, George and Mac and Edward, I believe. Anyway, there was four of them, and Jake is still living in White Springs, has a pretty nice home near the Colored Methodist Church. And he loves me. He still brings me some hand saws to fix once in a while, and throws his arm around my neck and hugs my neck. Tells me, "Captain, I love you." I said, "Well, Jake, I love you too, and your brothers and all."
They called you Captain?
Yes, they called me Captain, because Miss Hamilton and I handed out a payroll, $3,000 payroll, for a good many years. We lived in what was known as the Dr. McManin House at that time. I rented that, and Mrs. Gordon Bullard would live there now. That was near the Matera House. Later, Tom Taylor and his wife lived in the Matera House, two-story house.
Where is that? Where in White Springs is that?
Well, it's about two blocks east of Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. And later I bought the Long place. And it had two houses. I lived in one of them a good many years. I finally sold one to Mr. Carr from Palm Beach. And then later we moved to Jacksonville and lived on North Macduff, 808 North Macduff Avenue in Jacksonville.
This was after your mill at White Springs?
Yes, ma'am.
How come you stopped milling?
Well, the timber gave out, and the war, when it ended, the mills, there was a lot of rusty smokestacks all over the country because they were not buying any more lumber much, you know, then. And there was no demand. And so we shut down the mill. And I went down to Jacksonville and helped to build 82 of those Liberty ships. I was a leaderman. Worked 11 men worked under me.
What does leaderman mean? Does that just mean
well,
like
a that's
foreman?
A man that's a foreman.
Uh-huh.
And I worked in the engine room mostly because I was familiar with the steam boilers and engines and machinery. And
these were steam operated ships, or they just the boilers were steam?
They were operated by steam. Wow. Most everybody them days they run by steam.
What year would you say this would be about?
Well, in 1942, along there. Mm-hmm. And there's a good many people round about through this North Florida and Middle Florida that worked in this shipyard. At one time, they had 22,000 people working in there.
This was right before World War II?
That was back in World War I.
Oh, okay.
It was engaged in war with the Germans at that time. And finally, the shipyard closed after the war was over. And I bought a store in Jacksonville on Hogan Street. It's actually north of Cohen Brothers, but it was downhill near the Hal Lynch Motors. Mm-hmm. Was across the street from our stores. It's now Lynch Davison.
What was your store called?
It was on Hogan Street in Jacksonville.
And what was the name of it? Mr. Hammock's?
Oh, our store?
Yeah.
Oh, it was W.H. Hammock's little store. And my name was on the plate glass window up until a few years ago. I had sold out to another man, and he was operating it. But my wife got sick and down in her back working on the concrete floor, and she come up to her daughter's up here in Jasper, lives next door to a doctor, and he doctored her up. And during the time, I got tired of the store business and sold out, and we moved back out near Lake City, and I had 20 acres out near the air base in Lake City, near the college. And I operated mills there for other people, mostly.
In Lake City?
When I lived in Lake City. And
was that out by the forest?
That was out from Lake City, 2 miles mm-hmm. out on 90, Road 90. Yeah. And finally, my wife got badly ailing, and we had to take her to the, what's the name of that hospital on the west side? Division Hospital, Dr. York. She had bleeding at the nose and almost died a time or two. Well, after that, she got well enough, she went back home, and my three daughters advised me to move to Jasper, where I'd be near my youngest daughter, Edna. She could help wait on her mom. And I decided to do that. So I did, and bought a home from Miss Worley on 41, and near, not far, about 2 blocks from the post office. And after moving here, she became ill again and had to go to the hospital and to the nursing home. So we moved here in 1946, I believe. I'm not too sure about it. Wait a minute. That's not right by any means. I moved to Lake City in 1946. Mm-hmm. Lived there 27 years. Actually, I've just been living up here now almost 6 years. We'll be 6 years in April.
Here in the early 1970s.
That's right. Early 1970s, and been living here ever since. And my wife, after moving her from one hospital to another nursing home, the government seemed to be urging the doctors to get them out of the hospital. They didn't want her to stay in the hospital much. And I couldn't find a nursing home with rooms available in North Florida and South Georgia. I tried Valdosta, and they was filled up, and Thomasville, Georgia, and they was filled. I finally got a room for her in Moultrie, Georgia. One of my nieces married a young man there named Millsap, and he is the postmaster of Moultrie, Georgia. He helped me to get a room for her at Robert Green's nursery in Moultrie, nursing home. Well, she stayed up there about 30 some odd days, and she began to have sores on her back. I wanted to move back to the hospital here, and my doctor told me I could move her back. $125 for an ambulance to bring her back to the hospital, same thing to carry up there. And she stayed in the hospital 1 week. And the doctor called me and told me they had a room for her in the nursing home in Jasper. I didn't much want to move over there, but he insisted and I moved her over there. And she stayed another 30 some odd days there. And then she had pneumonia and had a stroke and moved her back to the hospital. And she lived until the 26th day of December of 1977. And she died that night, that evening. And she's buried in White Springs by her daughter, Jewel.
And her family was from
Thomasville,
and but your sons and daughters are mainly around this area?
Well, my oldest daughter, Louise, was born 6 miles north of Thomasville, within speaking distance of Barnes Creek Church, near the Ocklawhinie River. And, of course, we didn't live there for a short time. And we moved back up in Georgia to run a sawmill for some time. And then we come back down to Woodville, Georgia. And I had a lumber mill there with a tram road to it, out near the Natural Bridge. I lived in Woodville, but out near the Natural Bridge on the St. Marks River is where the mill was located, and we cut some very good timber there for several years, and moved from there to Quitman, Georgia.
And you moved all over, didn't you?
Sawmill people have to move because the timber gives out, and they have to move to another body of timber.
What kind of timber?
Pine timber, mostly.
Yellow pine.
We cut some cypress and some other hardwood, but mostly pine.
Well, the trees that you were cutting down, how old would you say they were? How big were they?
Well, they had to be large enough to make, sometimes we'd cut a timber that would make 12 by 12. And some would be car sills, and some would make 7 by 16 railroad trestle stringers.
Oh, yeah.
And they had to be large logs.
Do you find anything like that anymore? Is there?
Well, very little of that large timber now, and most all of the yellow pine is gone.
Why is that? They just cut it and then they didn't replant it?
We didn't replant it for a long time, and now, of course, we do have some tree farms, and Uncle Sam is furnishing a lot of help to plant new farms, you know. Excuse me.
We turned off the recorder there for a minute while you talked, and you were talking about the yellow pine and that now they're starting to replant them anyway, but when you were cutting in South Georgia and North Florida, is that what they would call virgin timber that you were
cutting?
Yes,
ma'am, that was original yellow pine. You just don't find anymore. Even this replant that they're planting now is mostly slash pine, and it does not have the big heart that the yellow pine used to have. It's not quite as good. Don't make as good lumber. The lumber will warp if they're not careful in drying it, you know, seasoning it. I have operated lumber mills most of my life, and I built this mill down there at White Springs and built a tram road to it, operated there for a good many years. And I had two bills in my life, large enough to have tram roads to them. One was over there near Woodville, Florida. And the other one was in White Springs. Made some money fast and lost some fast. The larger the mill, the faster you can lose it.
As soon, was that after the lumber's gone and or after the economy, they weren't buying lumber anymore?
Well, this was speaking about when I operated the mill there, was when we was actually cutting this good timber. And it makes me feel a little sad sometimes to go along the road through South Georgia and North Florida and see large piles of sawdust where I sliced up the good logs many years ago, and there's not any more yellow pine now to cut. So.
But I guess back then, really, you didn't figure that you'd ever run out, really.
That's right. We thought it would never run out, but of course it did. And when I lived out from Lake City there, I operated a mill. I worked for wages, too, superintended mills for other people. Mr. Buck Lewis, who was originally from Jasper, he had a mill at Rayford, Rayford Station, on the Coastline Railroad. And he hired me to go down there and superintend and operate his lumber mill, which I did for about 3 years. And he paid me a very good salary at that time. I earned about $27 a day. And not many sawmill people in the whole country that at that time that earned that much for wages. But I finally had a heart attack when I was working with Mr. Lewis.
When was that?
Well, that was...
How old were you?
Well, I was about 68 years old, very long ago.
And you never had another one?
No, I had a heart attack 2 or 3 times.
You have?
Yes, ma'am. After I come home, of course, I couldn't sawmill then, and went to 2 or 3 different doctors, and they all told me that I'd better take it easy and that I'd have to have treatment for my heart trouble. And I finally had Dr. Sasso, an Italian fellow, but Robert Sasso was a mighty fine young doctor, and he was a heart specialist. And he treated me, and I took his treatment for years and still take some of his tablets. However, he died with a heart attack several years ago himself.
And you must have been following good doctor's orders, because you're still with us.
I have some of his tablets in there that I take maybe every 2 months. Once in a great while, I'll have some pains in the side of my neck or something, dizziness, and I'll take those tablets. And I haven't been troubled too much with heart attacks in the last 8 or 10 years. But my wife began to get badly ailing, and we had to move up here, and she never did get much better.
When you moved up here, was that when you first opened the saw business, the saw shop?
No, I had a saw shop when I lived out from Lake City.
Oh, you did?
I hammered saws, been hammering saws ever since before I married.
That's part of being in the sawmill business, being able to make...
At off hours, I would hammer saws for other sawmill people. They would bring me saws from far and near to hammer. And to sharpen, of course, and I sharpened all kinds of saws and other edge tools.
Well, how did you ever learn how to hammer one of those saws?
Well, my father had sawmill and learned me how to file and sharpen and all, but he didn't know how to hammer. My oldest brother didn't know how to hammer, but he would let me try it once in a while. I found out that I didn't know much about it. So I went out to Lumberton, Mississippi, and boarded at the hotel at a very large lumber mill there. The place was named Lumberton because it was a very large mill and they had so much lumber there. Mr. J.H. Minor, the great saw man, he had 2 small boys. They'd be around to play with me sometimes. I'd take up a little time with them, but I was in his filing room. He had 4 other young men working as apprentice to learn how to hammer. And he had the right from his company to teach others along with his keeping up the source for this company. Mm-hmm. So he asked me if I'd had experience before, and I made a mistake by telling him yes, that I had. I was a young man, and I wanted to tell him I knew some. I was hardly grown at that time. And I told him that I had taken some lessons through the mail, and that my brother taught me some. Oh, well, he says, you ought to learn soon, having had some experience before. I found out later that I'd better told him I didn't know anything about it. He took an old saw that was crooked up.
Hammered a wind in it. What's a wind?
He hammered a wind in the saw, which is difficult for any saw hammer to get out. And he told me that he was going ahead to look after his other work, and that he'd see me later for me to go ahead and take the straight edges and the hammer and put it on the anvil and hammer it and try to straighten the saw. I commenced, and I soon found that I didn't know how to straighten that saw. I worked at it for a long time and become disheartened and disgusted, and sat down on the workbench for a while, and he would go see the other boys, but he wouldn't ever even look over my way. He was testing me out. And he went around until lunchtime. He blew the large whistle and made a loud noise for lunchtime. One of the boys come by and says, Hammer, come on, let's go to the hotel, get some dinner. I says, all right, and he asked me as he was going down out of the mill if I thought I was going to be able to fix that saw. I says, I'm not doing so well on that saw. I'm afraid I won't be able to fix it. He said, well, you'll learn. So we went on to lunch and come back after lunch, and I tried another way to try to hammer the saw, and it got worse. Everything I'd done to it, it seemed like it was getting worse. Mr. Minor wouldn't come around to see about me. I sat down to rest again for a while, and finally took up my hammer and started on it again, and he came around finally, and he says, well, young man, how you getting along on this hammering? And Mr. Minor, I'm not doing so well on the saw. Well, he says, you told me you knew a good deal about it, and you think you're going to be able to straighten that saw? I says, no, sir, I don't believe I know how to straighten that saw. He says, good. Put his hand on my shoulder. He's good. He says, now I can learn you. Because you told me you knew a good deal about it, and if a fellow already knows something, you can't learn him much. You've got to find out he don't know before you can learn it. And I'll never forget what he said about that. So he marked it off for me and told me to hammer where he marked off and listen closely to what he told me, and he finally learned me how to straighten the saw. And, of course, since that time, I had to pay him $75 for my
for your lessons?
For my lessons that I took from him.
How long did you stay there?
I was out there about a week and a half, 2 weeks. And I come back home to Georgia, began to hammer saws around home some. But I found out from time to time that I would run into difficulties, because saw hammering is very technical and complicated, and if you don't know just where to hit, it's better maybe not to hit at all. You got to know how heavy to hit the blows and where to hit, and take your straight edges and mark it off. So I learned to be a saw hammerer and spent many years at it, along in my spare time, and after I retired from my heart attack and was able to work again, I worked in my shop at home and fixed the saws for Southern Wood Preserving Company near Lake City and for the T.A. Daniels Lumber Company near Lake City.
Did you actually hammer the saws for
them? I hammered all the saws. Mr. Daniels and the Southern Wood Preserving Company wouldn't let anyone else fix the saws because I knew how. And since I moved to Jasper, they've brought me many saws up here to fix. You see them scattered all around there, some of the old ones have got cracks in them.
Mm-hmm. Are they still using those? Or are they do they just want them fixed for themselves?
Well, they have several saws, and they can go ahead and use the saws they have and bring me the ones that are dull and those that are bent up, you know, and have bent places, and they become heated in spots as large as your hand that's not too hot, and turn blue, and there'll be a big bump on it at that particular point, and you would dash them to hit very hard blows in that particular place because the temper in the middle has been destroyed to some extent. You have to stretch out the steel away from that and pull it out.
How would you do that?
Put it on the anvil and hammer it with a hammer weighing about 5 pounds, a special hammer that's made with a little bit of crown to it.
The one you were using out there, which just looks pretty heavy, and it's...
5 pound hammer, that's mm-hmm. right. Same regular saw hammer, and you have to have straight edges, and an anvil with a very little bit of crown to the surface of it. Hammer on, and hang it on the hook, and take the straight edges and put up on the saw and mark it off where it needs to be hammered, then lay it back up on the anvil and hammer it until it becomes straightened. Then, if it runs at a high RPM speed, why, the speed force or centrifugal force is very strong force, and you have to hammer some tension in the saw about halfway between the eye and the rim of the saw, an area of about 5 inches all the way around the saw, to put some tension in the saw to where it will be limber in the middle.
So, in other words, you would hammer an area all the way around the saw about 5 inches wide in order to make the saw...
The tension in it so it would stand in the centrifugal force. If it has about 800 RPM speed, it will not run if it don't have some tension in it. It has to have tension to run at a high speed. Even at 600 RPM, it has to have some tension in it. And it takes experience to learn how to put that tension in the right place and how much to put and how heavy to hit the blow.
Well, so, do they get bent up quite a bit in the sawmills? Do the saw blades get bent up quite a bit?
Yes, ma'am. It's always been a mystery how the little thin disc of steel could stand up there and stand the abuse that it has to stand. You have a steam feed, baby, shoving the carriage through at a high rate of speed, almost equal to a passenger train. And to see that saw slice those large logs up at that speed and all, it's a little mystery. And the manufacturers who manufacture the saws, they have to really know what they're doing and put the hardness in the saw, the temper in the middle correctly, and make the teeth right with the right kind of swage on them and everything about the saw business. So it's a long story, of course, but it's been my occupation for most all of my life.
Has anyone ever learned from you?
Well, I have learned this Mr. Enfinger, who lives in Lake City and is a saw filer, Al Sawyer. He is a sawyer for T.A. Daniels Lumber Company.
What does the term sawyer mean?
He's the one that stands up there and you pull the lever and makes it...
Oh, makes the saw
carriage
run.
Go through
to
saw the logs. Uh-huh. And at these larger mills, he has what they used to call a steam nigger, but they don't have steam now, and they use a hydraulic motor to kick the logs on the carriage and to turn the logs. Turn them with power, turn them. And he has to be able to operate that. He also has a large die, about 12 inches in diameter, with figures on it to show what he wants to cut on lumber. And he has to set his head block. It's a push button operation. He pushes the button and it does it by a motor. It sets the head blocks.
What are the head blocks?
Headblocks is where the log lays on the carriage. It pulls it through to be sawed.
Uh-huh.
And it has to be on a carriage with mm-hmm. steel wheels and steel track, like a railroad track, and go back and forth. And it all has to be very true with a little bit of lead. Very small amount of lead in the mandrel. That means leading inside so that it will not rub the log too hard.
I see.
So that's about the operation of the sawmill business.
Well, the sawmill today, like the sawmills in Lake City today, are they very different from the sawmills that you had in White Springs? Are they pretty much run the same way?
They are all on the very same principle, only we used to use steam power, a very large steam engine, and we have to have a generating boiler to generate steam, or maybe two large boilers to generate enough steam to run the large steam engine. That big steam engine would pull everything around the mill, have belts and shafting to run on to pull different things about the mill. That's the operation of lumber business. I have operated for other people quite a bit during my lifetime too. I've been in the sawmill business 6 times, and 2 of them was large enough to have tramroads to them.
Well, the one that you had down in White Springs, did it have a name? Was it called Hammocks, W.H. Hammocks Sawmill?
Yes, ma'am. I had a partner one time. A.W. Cheshire was in with me a while, and then I run it by myself, W.H. Hammock, a lumber company. It was Cheshire and Hammock when he and I was in together. But he was not in with me very long.
Was he a White Springs man?
Yes, ma'am. His family lived round about. Some of them lived round about there yet. Mm-hmm. The Cheshires, and I think maybe they might be Jim Cheshire's children. Some of them lives within the town of White Springs, I'm sure, yet. In fact, I met one a few days ago at the hospital. And her father was Jim Cheshire, and he cut meat for us. During the time I was in the sawmill business there, I also had a store down near the depot in White Springs.
You did?
And
What did you sell?
A man named Morris Parnell operated the store for me.
Huh.
Finally, I gave him a half interest in it, and he worked out a half interest in it. And we run the store there, and we finally had another store downtown in White Springs.
Near where the S&S store is now? Or whereabouts was it? Was it near the Adams Country store?
It was near where Adams store is. It was near there where we had the store.
What did you sell?
Well, we had grocery store. And you couldn't run me fast enough to give me a store anymore. Ms. Hammock was in the store that I owned in Jacksonville. I bought out the store there and operated for a year or two. There was 3 men wanting to buy it, and I let one of them buy it. I believe I told you already that she had to come to the doctor.
All right.
And so I got out of the store business and come back to my sawmill business, moved out near Lake City.
Does Mr. Parnell, does he still own a store? Or?
Mr. Parnell died several years ago. And
what was the name of the store?
The store was just Mr. Parnell run it in his name mostly, but it was actually, I owned all the stock in it for a good while. And it got to be Hammock and Parnell.
Mm-hmm.
But the one we run down town, the same name,
mm-hmm.
and we had another man that worked in there, Jim Stallman, worked with us some, cut meat for us, finally sold that store to a man named John Jones.
What years was this around the 1920s, or when
that,
was
that
it?
That was long in the 20s.
This is when White Springs was a lot bigger than it is now?
Yes, it was thriving little town at that time. Of course, a good many years before, I'd say long about 19 and 12 or 14. We had a large fire there, burned a good portion of the town, you know.
Were you there then?
No, ma'am. I was then living up in Georgia.
Oh, I see. But so this was before you ever came to White Springs. They had a big fire.
Large fire and burned up a good portion of the town. They built it back, and there was quite a few hotels there, about 7 or 8 hotels.
Really?
The Telford Hotel, you know about it.
That's still standing. That's still the standing. Only one standing, I think.
And the Edgewood Hotel is burned now. And
where was that?
That was over there near the gate, the south gate going into the Steamboat Memorial.
Yeah.
Right across near there. And the Colonial Hotel was over there. And the Suwannee River Lodge was over there. And a good many of them had boarding houses. Mr. Taylor had boarding houses, a good many of the boarding houses and other hotels in White Springs, and they were all doing a good business at that time. A lot of people come to White Springs for the benefit of the mineral water there.
Did you go swimming in the spring house?
A few times. My children were good swimmers in there. My two older girls would dive off of the top banisters in the spring house into that spring anytime. Anytime, and oh, there's a lot of the boys round about town that was almost like alligators in that water there. Some of those same boys that I had pushing logs off of the shoals on the river, they were good in spring, uh-huh. Divers and swimmers. And it was a good life that we had in White Springs. I learned to love many people. I wanted to love everybody in the world, and we did. And I joined the First Baptist Church in White Springs about 1926 or 27. And I've been a deacon in the church for many years, almost from the time I joined. Soon after I joined, they made a deacon, or I was ordained as a deacon in the church in White Springs. And I've been a deacon ever since. I'm mighty sorry when I ring, but I'm trying to serve the Lord. And I'm a deacon at present in the First Baptist Church in Jasper. Ms. Hamilton was along here, too, till she died. And is there much more you want information?
Oh. Well, We can just finish up. You know, I've got some tape left and whatever. Are you getting tired?
No, not especially.
The Bullard family. A few more things of information. I'm real interested about the history of White Springs, especially since that's where I'm from. And I know you're really good friends with Mrs. Saunders, and she's one of the leading ladies of town. And
did she tell you something about me?
She said, you know, she had mentioned that you were up here and that I should come talk to you, that you knew all about.
I'd like you to talk to her. Bonnie B. Bullard, she used to be. She's married a Hill House, and they live on the east side of town.
The east side.
Out beyond Carver's store.
Oh, yeah.
And Lawrence Carver there, he worked at my sawmill when he was a boy.
How many did you employ in your sawmill?
Well, we had anywhere from 50 to 80 people.
Oh.
We had some in the woods cutting timber, and some hauling the logs to the tram road, and some operating, and some building the tram road, and took a good many around the mill to operate it and haul the lumber away and load the lumber when it got to the railroad. I shipped many carloads of lumber by way of Shenandoah Junction and all up north. It's a different railroad company. We cut a lot of long car sales them days. It was worth a little bit more than other lumber.
Well, then, your lumber company, if that employed about 50 to 80 people, was that one of the biggest industries in the area, well, in the town?
The lumber and the turpentine industry was the only industry we had in this whole community.
When did you usually wait until, like the turpentine people, did they use the same kind of trees that you were cutting? Or
they were supposed to go ahead and operate their turpentine business ahead of the sawmill business.
And after it was all turpentined out,
right,
then you'd come in and cut the timber?
We'd cut in behind the turpentine people. Once in a while, we'd cut some timber that was called round timber. It hadn't been chipped or boxed, you know. Them days they cut boxes in the trees. Later they began to hang cups on them and not cut the boxes.
They would cut a whole big box in there and just collect it in there.
Put a box down into the tree and ship the tree and let it run the turpentine down into the box. They'd have a dipper made especially to dip the turpentine out and put it into a bucket and they'd carry it. Let it rub against the ledge and get turpentine all over. Carry it till it gets full, and carry it to a barrel and empty it into a barrel.
Well, were there very many turpentine operations around here?
Quite a few. I would say there was at least five within an area of 20 miles square around about White Springs and Jasper. Might have been more than that. I know there's at least five. The Bullards had a turpentine still up the Woodpecker route. And of course it was not any route at that time, it was just a roads, country road. But it later got to be the Woodpecker route, and is yet. And they were very fine people, and some of the first people I met when I come down here. One of them married Chess Sweat in White Springs, and she's Mrs. Essie Sweat, lives out near Swift Creek Methodist Church. And she brought me a large cake a few days ago. They all love me and I love them. They're good Christian friends and neighbors.
Do you know Bobby Bullard and the young boys, Lane Bullard, they're...
Yes, C.C. Bullard.
Yeah.
He married, that's Bonnie B.'s brother. Bonnie B. Bullard, she's Bonnie B. Hillhouse now. C.C. Bullard married a girl here and lives here in Jasper now. And then there was Donald, I believe, Bullard. Several of the Bullard boys, and the older ones was Gordon Bullard, and his wife lives in the old Dr. Mac Manning house, yet if she's still living. I'm not sure that she is still living, but they own that place. That was the oldest one of the boys. Then there was Collie Bullard. He was lived in White Springs and a very good friend and neighbor to us and his family. And his wife was a Carter. And she was a very close kin to Harry T. Reed, the undertaker here. He's her nephew because her sister is his mother. And he is a very good friend of mine here, too. He was the undertaker that buried my wife on the 28th, I believe, of December. And all the funeral bills and nursing home bills and the hospital bills is all paid up to now that I have received the bills. But it has taken many thousands of dollars. At one time, I had my hip broken here, the year before last, and I had to go to Valdosta, and Dr. Campbell put three pins in there as a compound fracture of the hip. I had to stay up there about a month or so in the hospital and in the nursing home together. They charged $40 for an ambulance to take you from the hospital right across the street to the nursing home. I come back home, and through the prayers of my church people and my family, the good Lord brought me out of that in a few days. I had a walker here that I was walking with. Finally got to where I could walk with a stick up to the post office to get my mail, about two blocks. And then I got to where I could walk without any stick. And later I bought that tricycle, and I'm using that yet. I don't use any stick of any kind.
Well, what do you think?
At that time,
what do you think causes your great ability to recover from everything and to live so long? You said you've had about 2 or 3 heart attacks and a broken hip. Do you just live well?
Well, he's been a merciful God to me. That's one thing I can say. And I should be very thankful that he's been such a good and merciful God. I'm not sprouting any wings. I'm not so good. But I'm trying to live close to the Lord as I know how to walk. And I'm a deacon, and of course the Bible says that deacons would be, says, choose from among ye 7 men of good report, men who are not given to much strong drink, men who are husbands of one wife, men who are apt to teach. Maybe I haven't been so apt to teach, but I taught the camp boys, Raymond and Buddy, John Council, in White Springs when they were boys. Their mother, Sally Camp, and the 2 boys live near me now, about a little over a block from me now. And they're fine boys, and they don't go like they ought to, but they're good boys, and they honor me and respect me, and I love them. She's a mighty good lady. She'll come to see Ms. Hamilton as long as she lives. This camp is getting a little age on her now. She's a mighty fine lady. She lived in White Springs a long time, and in the old Dr. Camp house. She moved from there up here because the boys didn't want to live by herself after her husband died. So, my experience at White Springs, there's a lot of things that I don't care too much about telling. I was chief of police there one time for a good long time.
When was that?
About the meanest job I ever saw.
When were you chief of police?
Oh, I was chief of police there back about, I'd say, 30 years ago, something like that.
You didn't like that job, though?
Ma'am?
You didn't like that job?
I didn't like it. The meanest job I ever had.
Really?
They told me around there that I made the best one that they ever had, but I pitied the worst. It's a mean job because just one man, you know. I read the meters, and I operated the pumping machinery there, you know, the waterworks in White Springs. I was familiar with machinery, and I operated that and read the meters. I was cow catcher and dog catcher and everything else. And naturally, some people would be pleased when you cut the cows, and others would be very much displeased when they had the cows in the pound.
Put cows in the pound?
I had to put them in the pound because people complain. They call me across town and tell me the cows is eating up their garden, and I had to go get them and put them in the pound. And hogs too sometimes. This is a nuisance almost. I hated the job, but I stayed with it a pretty good while. But I never did care much about that job, and I'm glad to get away from it. And of course, I went back to my sawmill business and spent a good many years at it since. And now I'm supposed to be retired, but I still fix saws.
You still work?
I'm still working. I have a saw shop here, and I hammer saws and sharpen all kind of saws and all other edge tools. And a lot of people from White Springs brings me work, saws to fix, and from Liable, from many other places, as far away as Valdosta, and as far away as Folkestone, Georgia, 96 miles, down below Branford, Florida. All down there, they bring me saws to hammer. And I have 15 saws waiting for you to fix out there now. Some hand, eight hand saws and 7 skill saws. And I also have 2 table saws to fix, waiting for me out there now.
Do you have any that are waiting to be hammered?
Well, the two there that's got to be hammered, yes, ma'am. They're not the large ones. They're about 30 inches in diameter.
How big are the large
ones? Like the one that I laid up on the anvil there. Uh-huh. It's got to be hammered some more.
Right. How big are the large ones, Beth?
Well, they run up to 56, and once in a while they have one even 72 inches, so 6 feet. Those
wow.
Very large ones are more difficult to handle and to run, to operate.
How heavy would that be, Beth?
That's much too heavy for one man to handle. It takes about two men to handle. I have to have a helper. I had a regular man to help me when I had my... I was recuperating from my hip being broken.
Yeah.
I had a man to help me there for a month or two. Strickland, Pete Strickland, lives about three blocks. He has a little apiary, beehives, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Makes some honey. He gives me some nice honey about every spring. A good fellow. One of his sons is a policeman in Jacksonville. A nigger shot him here last year. But he's got over that, and he's back on the job. So far as I know, he's still a policeman. Something else you want to ask me now?